Hey there. Welcome back to Affirmative Action. I'm your host, Antoinette Grajeda. In what's been one of the strangest years of our lives, I think it was easy for some of us to almost forget it is an election year. With November just around the corner, now seems like a perfect time to shift our focus to politics. I promise we'll have a conversation about the pandemic, just not today. Instead, today we're going to travel back in time. Think back to the fall of 2019, when there was a lot of discussion about how diverse the group of candidates seeking the Democratic presidential nomination was. Several groups were represented: women, African Americans, Asian Americans, Latinos, and the LGBTQ community. However, by March, the field had narrowed to two white men, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. It was against that backdrop that we recorded this episode's conversation. My guests and I spoke just days before the pandemic arrived in Arkansas in March, and it's been sitting on the shelf while the world adjusts to a new normal. Even though the conversation took place 6 months ago, it's still as relevant as ever in an election where we now know the Democratic and Republican presidential candidates are two white guys, a typical situation for our nation. One thing that has changed since our conversation, however, is the nomination of Senator Kamala Harris as the Democrats' pick for vice president. Harris is the first African American, first Asian American, and third female vice presidential candidate on a major party ticket. So is this a sign of progress in terms of representation in politics? I guess only time will tell. Although a person of color did not win the nomination as the Democratic presidential candidate, the race for the nomination did create space for conversation. What does it mean to have elected leaders reflect the demographics of the constituents they serve? Have we made any progress nominating and electing more diverse candidates? If we want candidates to have more varied backgrounds than we've seen in the past, how do we change that? What are some of the barriers keeping diverse candidates from running? These are some of the questions addressed by today's panel of guests, which includes Naja K. Baptist, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Arkansas, Irvin Camacho, a community organizer from Springdale and the Democratic candidate for District 89 State Representative in 2016, and Janine Perry, Professor of Political Science at the U of A and Director of the Arkansas Poll. To begin the conversation, I asked my guests to share their reactions to seeing a diverse field of Democratic presidential candidates in the fall of 2019.
To me, it was the strongest reflection we've seen of the actual Democratic voter electorate, and seemed like kind of the culmination of a lot of the conversations that we've been having over several decades. So I was optimistic that the Republic stood a chance of making a pretty significant leap forward in terms of achieving John Adams' vision of being a portrait in miniature of the Republic we serve. But we need to remember that's just one office at one level. There have been some other changes, but it's certainly very high priority, very high profile. So it was significant, I think, for a lot of people for those reasons.
I saw it as a more of a kitchen sink model, right? It was kind of throw something at the wall and see what sticks, especially for the black candidates that were presented. I mean, it was, like Dr. Perry was saying, it was a diverse array of candidates, but there was always a problem of substance, right? Diversity seems in this country to have this denotation of simply just tokenism, someone who looks like me, more of a descriptive versus a substantive representation. And the question was, were we going to be able to find someone who was going to be able to unify the party, not just in a symbolic way, but more in a substantive manner? I think that was a question we were trying to answer, which I definitely got it. But I think there was an issue of keeping too many candidates in the race too long. Mm-hmm. And, I always talk about political dystrophy, the idea of people not using their political muscle that much, right? And so I don't know if we put people in too many marathons too soon, right, with too many people. And it was a paradox of choice.
I was very ecstatic and concerned at the same time. ecstatic because first time we ever have a progressive Mexican-American candidate in Julian Castro. He made his announcement in front of the Virgin Mary, which is a big deal in our community.
Yeah.
So seeing that made me feel ecstatic, but very concerned to see that there was so many candidates that were running. And I felt that it was going to be so long, that this primary was going to take so long, cause a lot of stress, get a lot of people in the community to fight against each other, even though they're on the same side. And that's exactly what ended up happening.
Fracture.
Well, Najah, you touched on something I want to discuss, this idea of substance.
Yes.
There's, you know, long been a discussion of having this republic that is reflective of the people who live in it, right? But at the same time, do you just vote for someone because they check that box, because she's a woman, because she's black, because he's Asian, whatever it happens to be? You still want someone, in theory, who can do the job. So how do you get that substance, especially when, if you want to get into it, a lot of times, you know, there are these studies about how minority communities are at a disadvantage to begin with when it comes to, say, education or socioeconomic issues.
Well, I think what you saw first in this election was the idea that the black vote, there's always a people of color umbrella.
Right.
But there's also a specific space in which black voters struggle from. But I think what we saw in this election was, especially with Harris and Booker, was the idea of this array of the black vote, right? That it not being such a monolithic type of thing, solely based on this low income, low performing, but you saw this spectrum, right, of black political candidates. But then there's also a question of, you know, Kamala, she checked all the boxes, right? She was a well-established black woman from Howard University, the Mecca, as well as she was a part of all the sororities, and you know she had all the signifiers, and the indicators. But at the end of the day, she couldn't create a message that resonated well, even with black women. And we saw this at the Essence Festival, when she literally, a lot of black women say that she literally disconnected. She had no idea, you know, how she was talking to who she was talking to. And I think she tried to have. I mean, this is what Barack Obama ran on, this kind of deracialized universal platform in 2016 and 2018. But I don't think that still had the same effect during the early parts of the primary. I think now that we're down to the end, I think once you saw Harris and Booker leave, it's a question of, you know, what part of the black vote will now become salient. And that you saw that in South Carolina, where it was the older black machine politics, the idea of pragmatic politics, let's just try to beat Donald Trump. And that means, you know, getting behind Joe Biden with all his problems and all of his issues, because we don't want to scare. And this is a question, and this is something that's really been kind of haunting the Democratic Party, is the idea they've been chasing center, right? Chasing center. And so you always think about the official center, the real center. But there's an artificial center that's been pulled. It keeps being pulled.
Which way?
Right. I mean, that's mainly what happened with the election of Donald Trump. It got pulled
to the right.
Of course. And so you have to try to go to where the voters are, right? And so the question is, how do we then appeal if we lose Kamala and Corey, which was never really considered to be substantive black candidates, right? Maybe based on descriptors, right? A symbolism. Yes, Kamala spoke well, and Corey had a PhD from the hood, whatever that means. but the fact of the matter is, they never really connected to the entire base of black voters to the point that they felt confident in it. And I think it's a little angst because of the Barack Obama effect, right? Because you expect Barack Obama to be able to do a certain amount, even though it was realistic with the type of Congress that he had to face. But I think the same thing is, like, I don't think black voters were just like, we just want to vote for somebody black, right? They wanted to vote for, for Latino voters, the same thing. It's like, we don't just want to vote somebody who looks like us. We want somebody who's going to actually present our issues and try to get these interests passed. And the question, that's two different questions on presenting it and getting passed through a obstructionist Congress, which I don't think Biden can do. But That's a different conversation.
But yeah, Irvin, you mentioned, you know, the candidate you were excited about. Was it just because of his background, or were you excited about his ideas too?
Well, I was excited about his immigration policy, but similar to what Dr. Baptist just said, that there was a disconnect because Julian Castro did not speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So he couldn't go on these major Spanish outlets and talk directly to the voters. And that was one of the biggest disconnects that he had. I mean, he had the immigration policy that was good for us, probably some of the best immigration policy that we've ever seen from a candidate.
Mm-hmm.
But folks, specifically within the Latinx community, they're more connected with Bernie Sanders than they are with any other candidate. And you see it because he won California. But just in general, even through my friend circle, before, even when Julian was running, Bernie was their candidate, which was very, very interesting to me. But it was based on the fact that, I mean, Bernie wants to abolish ICE. He wants to have immigration reform.
I wonder, too, if we could just return to what the research says about descriptive representation. Mm-hmm. Because I think on the one hand, you know, it's important to talk about how there can be a distinction between checking the boxes and what the person would actually do or what the person would be able to do, because they're the people who can check the boxes are usually the people without the experience it takes to get things done. So there's that conundrum that you end up in terms of trying to expand your republic. But my area of familiarity, the central one, has to do with women in politics. And we actually have a lot of data about that, because women started entering the state legislatures at significant enough levels that we could observe their behavior there and the effect they were having in the 1970s, in some states at least, not all states. And then that slowly ticked up until the 1970s, until we had about 1 in 5 of the 7,200 or whatever state legislators around the country were female. So we could begin to see what difference it made, right? There are those laboratories of democracy. We have a handful of governors, of course, we can look at, and a few members of Congress. But the states really afforded us a place to see what difference descriptive representation makes. And using that for my evidence, I want to suggest that it makes an enormous difference, having those people in those positions. And most of them are Democrats. But many of them are Republicans. And the thing I would note that a lot of the scholars in this area have commented on a lot as well is you don't have to vote the same way on the same issues, but women, Democrat and Republican, they have different policy priorities. Mm-hmm. And those policy priorities are more likely to be in line with the policy priorities of women voters, who've been the majority voters in the country since 1980, mm-hmm. in almost every election at almost every level. And we forget that. So in that sense, they're not a political minority when it comes to voting. Obviously, when it comes to office, they very much are.
Yeah.
But we know that they serve on different kinds of committees, some by assignment, but increasingly by choice. They sponsor and co-sponsor different kinds of bills, and they vote in distinctive ways. And we can actually, controlling for other factors even, then manipulate those states, you know, that range anywhere from 10% female to, hello, Nevada, 50% plus female in their state legislatures. And the more women there are total in that state legislature, the more women-friendly, according to the Institute for Women's Policy Research, which is nonpartisan and nonprofit, the more women-friendly policies they produce. So descriptive representation matters in part because it causes substantive representation, right? Substantive representation that really captures what we're supposed to be doing in a republic. So I think it's really important to note that as well. And women afford us a good opportunity to test to test the evidence and see what it produces.
Can you take that information and extrapolate it to another minority group? Or we don't know that yet because we haven't had enough to do that's not a fair transition?
Yeah, because the pool you're drawing from is statistically smaller, right, than 51% of the population.
Right.
And so that growth has been slower, and it's harder to find. You know, you can find standout characters, and you can draw conclusions from them, but then it's a lot like looking at Sandra Day O'Connor on the U.S. Supreme Court and saying, see, this is what a woman Supreme Court justice is like. Ta-da! You know, it's one woman. So we don't have quite the end we would like. One of the groups I think that's really interesting about, too, is gays and lesbians, mm-hmm. and we just, you know, it's such a significant part of our broader culture, and the expansion of rights and liberties has been so much faster than anything we've seen before for an underrepresented group. But we don't have enough. It's too small a portion of the population, and also too small a portion of elected elites for us to make scientifically valid, right. I guess, you know, to draw conclusions mm-hmm. about what that means. But the evidence thus far suggests that it's going to make a difference, right, descriptively and role modeling wise, but also substantively. But it's just a lot harder to draw conclusions. I'm less familiar with racial and ethnic mm-hmm. minority groups. I know there are scholars who do it.
Well, I mean, yeah, there are definitely scholars that do the work. Nadia Brown does has a book called Sisters in the State House. There's also been a couple books that looked at black mayors that ran a de-racialized campaign, which made mostly a point of descriptive. But I think since 1964, the black vote, when they had to kind of join the Kennedy Party, the idea of the black vote simply just being mushed along or pushed along, I think you saw that, again, this fracture after the Barack Obama effect. Frederick Harris' book, The Price of the Ticket, talks about this, like this kind of disillusionment, the idea of this slate ticket voting. And even though you have this, what Evelyn Simeon talks about in Historic First about women that ran for president, Shirley Chisholm, Hillary Clinton, et cetera, mm-hmm. it the script does give you a sense of empowerment. But the question is empowerment enough at this point, right? And so back to a point that everyone was making earlier about the idea of, you know, a candidate not being able to speak Spanish, it's the same thing as not being able to speak to the policy preference. Now, Kamala faced issues because, again, she checked all the boxes, but the problem was that she had this relationship with the police force, and there's an element of Black Lives Matter now that's within the black vote that has to be considered a strand. Of mm-hmm. course, you have your far right black neoliberals like, you know, Booker and such. They have already been in office and, you know, trying to create a pragmatic black pragmatic politics, right? But I think the idea of being able to have someone that substantively represents the issues is way more important, which is why you saw more black voters drifting towards Warren and Sanders and et cetera, et cetera. But I would say that I think we saw some glimmer of both the descriptive and the substantive with Stacey Abrams inside mm-hmm. Georgia, right? Because mm-hmm. Stacey was able to check all the boxes, right? Mm-hmm. Single mother, so on, such and such. But you got to realize you're dealing with a black vote that at one time chose Rosa Parks over Claudette Colvin, because Claudette Colvin was a single mother versus Rosa mm-hmm. Parks. But now you see the Stacey Abrams kind of like she has this different type of descriptive where it's like, oh, she's a single black mother, but she's a lawyer, but she did not engage in the same type of pay-to-play politics that Kamala did, right, while being inside the position. Like, will they? And so that's a question that we're trying to ask. Will that position change you once you get into office, mm. right, which would mean that the policies that you try to have come out the system, the outputs, right, will be not what we are seeking. And so it's the idea of the input, the throughput, and the output. But as Robert Smith argues in We Have No Leaders, most black leaders always face issues because they have to deal with issues of co-optation, neglect, and simply just kind of capitulating to whatever the party wants.
What is the advantage of having candidates that people can look at and say, oh, they look like me? Because it doesn't seem like that's necessarily the end-all be-all for when it comes to voting. Because, you know, just because I see a Latina doesn't mean I'm going to vote for her if I don't agree with her policies. I think mm-hmm. we've all kind of said, mm-hmm. you know, established that. But there does seem to be some benefits or some advantages to having other people on that stage or in that forum that aren't just old white men.
Yeah. There are measurable outcomes, and again, we can look to the states because there are so many of them, and there are so sure. many different situations and, you know, different branches of government. And one of the things we know is that the more female candidates and the more female winners across those states and the states that have more of them, not only do the policies change, but it's also the case that there have been studies of both girls and adult women to show that the knowledge gap closes when there are more people who are elites who look like them, probably because the attention gap closes. And so what that means is, generally speaking, if you ask about basic political information, the average female is going to answer questions less accurately than the average male, sometimes even controlling for other factors like education. I know that upsets a lot of people, but there are reasons for that. One of the reasons for that is it's not my game. It's not my
thing. It doesn't infect me. I'm not going to be a part of this game.
Girls and women, it's not a career trajectory for me. They're not doing things that matter to my life or mm-hmm. make a difference in how I care for grandma or what kind of jobs are available to me as a single woman needing childcare or whatever it happens to be. So we know that it increases the efficacy of girls and women, their feeling about their ability to change the world and their community. It affects their levels of political knowledge. And this is really important. It affects their sense of political ambition, which there's something that happens, and we know this from the amazing work of Jennifer Lawless. We know that between high school and college, something happens to our women citizens. That while the political ambition gap and the interest in leading and the belief that you can lead is pretty comparable between boys and girls up to the senior year in high school, these big 20% gaps grow between males and females in college in terms of their interest in running for office, their belief that they're qualified. Something just explodes. When they hit that early 20s level, those gaps close in the states that have more female candidates and or more female politicians. And, you know, I think that's enormous. It's kind of the long game, right? It's not the short game. It didn't help Elizabeth Warren or any of the other candidates mm-hmm. who are out there this time. But it will, over the long haul, make a difference.
Irvin, for you, you've run for office. Why did you feel compelled to run? Have you seen people that look like you? So you were inspired to run. What is kind of your story there?
Well, I mean, the history of Arkansas, people that have looked like me that have ran haven't been progressive for the most part, mostly on other sides of Arkansas. So I have that as an example. We did have folks here in Springdale, Diana Gonzalez-Worthen, Dr. Diana Gonzalez-Worthen, Yessi Gonzalez, I believe is her last name, who also ran. But It was pretty much like creating a blueprint. There was no one that could guide me of how it was to run as a Latinx man here in Arkansas, because you get a lot of pushback from all different areas. So it was important for me to run because I did want to break barriers, right? That's ultimately one of the things that you want to do. But I also wanted to encourage other folks to run for office, you know, not only Latinx men, but Latinx women as well, and just people of other marginalized communities. So that was one of the things that pushed me the farthest. Sometimes you want to give up, you know, you see how difficult it is canvassing at night. Sometimes you would go to neighborhoods at night trying to knock on doors and people would look at you suspicious. Like if you're trying to like steal from their cars or something, because you're going around at 6 p.m. around their neighborhoods trying to like give them a flyer of your campaign. So there's a lot of different, barriers that I had to get past in order to just be taken seriously. Specifically, I was running as a 24-year-old candidate mm-hmm. back then.
So age playing a role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was like the age factor. There was the fact that like usually Democrats didn't win in my district. You know, I'm a Latinx person running for office. Mm-hmm. But I was very, very happy because, I mean, we increased the voter turnout, but I believe 23% for a progressive candidate in my state race. And we got the Marshallese community to come out and vote, which was a big victory for me, you know, because usually you would hear of maybe one or two people from the Marshallese community that would come out. But we saw like over like 10 or 15. That's what we saw. So I imagine there was more. So there was these little small victories in between. But I think it kind of just built that base to just continue getting more people of color to run and have a blueprint where I can kind of talk to them and say, hey, you know, this is what worked for me. You know, you can do it a different route, but I'm going to give you the advice that you need just so you know what helped me and just make it your own. And that's one thing that I was really satisfied with at the end. Even though we didn't win, we did build that base. And luckily, Megan Godfrey ran in 2018 and she was able to win. And now we have a state representative who speaks Spanish in mm-hmm. our district, which is the biggest minority-majority district, I believe, in the entire state.
How much does money play a role in who can and cannot stay in a race? Because when people drop out, a lot of the times the thing that they say is, oh, I didn't have, initially, is like, well, we don't have enough funding to keep going. So how much of a role does money play? And is that an even bigger barrier for marginalized populations?
Well, look at all the self-funded female billionaires who came in, you know, laterally to this contest. It's enormous, right? The money matters and your connection to people with money. So since most people can't self-fund as billionaires, you have to look around. And we know that that's a huge reason why the traditional candidate pool looks like it normally does and why it was so surprising that it looked like it did in 2020 mm-hmm. on the Democratic side. To a certain extent, mm-hmm. in recent years, we shouldn't forget on the Republican side, they've been diversifying as well.
Sure.
And that's not a particularly diverse constituency, but we've had some female Republicans run, Latinos, people of the Latinx background, et cetera. So, you know, that's been a little bit the case. But those folks traditionally don't have as much connection to the kind of the sources, right, that produce the money in politics. So you can look at the individuals themselves and the jobs they've traditionally held because of, say, the education tracks, right, that they moved up on or were prohibited from moving up on until the 1970s, in many cases, and 1980s for some positions for MBAs and JDs at elite colleges for women. If those tracks were off limits before, then that means you weren't sorority sisters with the people who are now in a situation where they can write you a check for the kind of money that a lot of these candidates are. So you may not have independent resources yourself, but you're going to have connections to the people who do. And that tends to be less true at the lowest level of offices, but it still matters, right? If you're running for school board, whether mm-hmm. you know everybody at Rotary and the Chamber of Commerce, yeah. and those tend to not be the most diverse clubs that anybody's ever seen. So the money matters a lot.
Yeah, luckily in 2016, like, I was able to outrace my opponent, which was, I don't know how I did that, but I did that. But I remember, like, my first meeting with my campaign manager. He said, okay, write down everyone in your family here and, like, let's ask them for money. And I was like, what? You know, like, first of all, it's already embarrassing to have asked me
yeah.
for money. And then I'm like, my family's probably not going to have any money to give.
Sure.
And back then, I was still building these connections with people, so there wasn't those resources. But then there's folks like Mike Bloomberg who have the money to be able to invest. There was even our family members, you know, people that never even really have conversations about specific candidates on a national scale were saying, you know, this Mike Bloomberg, he showed up during my soccer game while I was watching TV.
Really?
A Mexican soccer game, you know, uh-huh. that was broadcasted in a Mexican news
channel. So his ad popped up.
Yeah. So it's like he has access to this money. He's able to make this kind of connections, which are unfortunate, but... Even at the jail, there was this lady there who was bailing out, I think her son, and she was like, I haven't voted yet, but I'm going to go vote for my Bloomberg because I believe that he has the money to win and he can maybe just buy Trump or something, you know?
Really?
So these kind of statements that are so scary to hear mm-hmm. as a person of a marginalized community, mm-hmm. you know, that fears deportation, that mm-hmm. fears discrimination against a lot of our communities of color. But there are people that think like that, unfortunately, and it roots from having those resources, being able to put money out there.
It seems that there are a lot of barriers to entry for marginalized communities. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the political system as it is now is rigged, is maybe even racist?
There are many barriers to prevent diverse fields from emerging and to... maintain that traditional candidates emerge even out of that diverse field, since that's the place we started. There are economic barriers, there are cultural barriers, and there are literal institutional, you know, barriers that have to do with when and how we vote and whether those institutions are more status quo increasing, like the Electoral College, or status quo enhancing or preserving instead of, you know, changing with the people. So there are all these barriers in place. So I think that's what makes it really important then, but it increases the hurdles for all the other stuff then that you have to do mm-hmm. if you're someone who wants a more diverse field and a more diverse class of elites doing the governing. And the number one thing we know, again, from the work of Jennifer Lawless and a lot of other people for decades with respect to women or any other politically marginalized group, we have to ask them to run. That's one really powerful thing that costs us absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. We have to encourage them and ask them and then ask them again and then mm-hmm. encourage them again to run, because there are all those other obstacles there, and we may not be able to help with a lot mm-hmm. of those obstacles, but we know if we can say to someone, because a white male is much more likely to self-nominate mm-hmm. and all these other groups are much less likely to self-nominate for mm-hmm. these positions, if we can say, Najah, I think you're a leader. I think people would follow you into a fire. Will you please consider running? I happen to know that, you know, this school board candidate is stepping down next time, and the Chamber of Commerce and Rotary and the district itself, you know, they're kind of shopping for people they think would do a good job. Could I put your name forward with the people I know as someone they should approach? Those indirect techniques and those indirect contacts, they're happening all the time. And the younger folks, right, they need to hear it over and over and over again. I think you're a leader. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to surmount because they don't think of themselves as a leader. Most people don't think they look like a leader. But we're just going to have to very slowly and deliberately make this new vision of leadership ourselves.
And I heard sometimes you have to ask a woman 7 times before she ever even agrees that she is good enough to run for office.
Right. The assumption is, and we see big gaps, right, in this, is that they're not qualified, right? And this goes back to little boys and little girls in the classroom, like, sure, I'll guess the answer. And little girls sitting there going, I don't think I should say anything. You know, they're just so, and then they just go, you know, in a divergent paths from that beginning. So, yeah, it's just different. And I think it really applies to just about any, you know, non-traditional group because so few leaders look like them. It makes it hard for us to see ourselves that way, and it makes it hard for others to see us that way.
So it seems like it turns into a chicken or an egg thing that we say we want more people, diverse people to run, but diverse people don't want to run because they don't think they can do it because they don't see it. And then,
because there's a system that's been pushing them back for, you know, for many, many years. So it's kind of difficult to kind of take that step forward when a lot of times society tells you that you shouldn't be in these kind of leadership positions.
Wait, if you were left out of the Republic for the first 100 years by design, it's kind of hard to see yourself as a member of the Republic.
About 400. Mm-hmm. But it's also an idea of, I think, political alienation, because when you see candidates that look like you that have been, we've been making these efforts since 1972 when we made the shift at the Gary Convention within the Black community. And again, the Black community is not monolithic. So I mean, it includes race, class, gender, sexual orientation. And so when we made the shift in 72 and we separated ourselves from our tradition of grassroots movements, and I always say that we never got the right to vote by voting for Black folks. We had it in 1865, from 1865 to 1877, right? Then we had to get it again in 1965, even after helping white women get the right to vote in the 1920s. Mm. So the idea is that we've always been this kind of like, we did everything right. Why is it that we no longer, and even when we check all the boxes, Melanie Price calls Barack Obama the race whisperer, right? He was the archetype Black candidate, right? He was able to speak to both sides. He had the demeanor. He had the family. He had everything perfectly correct. And he still wasn't enough. And you kind of see, and it's almost like, you know, when I was growing up and I first started engaging in protesting as a young man, my mama said, son, I don't want you to end up like King. Right? Mm-hmm. I don't want them to kill you like they killed King. I don't. And it's not just the physical death, right? It's the civil death. It's the stress that these leaders are under that you see in office, right? It's the stress of Maxine Waters having to put herself out here and become Auntie Maxine. And she's trying to tell them, hey, galvanize. The kid's like, man, listen, I don't want no parts of what they're doing to you, right? It's no one wants to really deal with the toxicity of the environment, because this is not the normal. We can all say this is not the normal political environment. And so all the pie in the sky dream that we once had, an idea of just, you know, you can do it, just grab yourselves up and you can do it. And it's like, no, I don't want no parts of that, right? I don't want the parts of a world where they literally tears you down. And everybody assassinates your character and assassinates you as a person. And you kind of telling these kids, okay, you still need to run, right? Okay, well, yeah, okay, kind of. But what about, you know, these issues? If we are to really deal with the barriers, one of the barriers we had to deal with first, I think, was efficacy, right? Not just external efficacy, if I can change the system, but internal efficacy, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to come from more than just having somebody who looks like us, especially for the Black community, because we have somebody who look like us, right? But they never seem to pan out. Mm-hmm. When we pull back the curtain, what do we find, right? Kamala was, and Cory Booker, again, you know, this idea of these Black neoliberals, but all you have to do is go back a couple years to the local politics. I mean, Cory Booker left Newark in shambles, right? Mm-hmm. Barack Obama barely voted when he was in Chicago. Kamala was, they said she was the police, right? Nobody wanted to deal with her. She was the police. And this idea, all you connected, I mean, it's more than just, and people think for Black community, it's about link fate. It's more than like fate. It's more than that, right? It's more than just thinking, well, something happened to someone else, maybe it happened to me, and I understand this because of my education or so-and-so. It's more than that. It's like, no, this has happened to me, right? And so what are you going to do to prevent that from happening again? Mm-hmm. And again, I think we have to figure out a better way to be able to not just simply say we want diversity, just having people in the room, mm-hmm. and to literally allow them to actually change the and shape the party, right? And not just have, say, oh, we have women in the room, but we don't deal with reproductive issues. We have black people in the room, but we don't deal with any of the substantive million-dollar blocks or the prison system or et cetera, et cetera. We can't just simply just keep trying to win the game, right, as opposed to understanding that the game is being played by people that get to define the game mm-hmm. and change the rules.
You're talking about change. How much does fear, and maybe specifically fear of change, play a role here, circling back to the presidential race? No matter who you vote for, Republican or Democrat, it'll once again be a white man in November. Mm-hmm. Is, you know, part of that, is that an example of people being afraid of change?
There's some literature about how people's expectations of, and most of it's been done on black candidates, particularly black male candidates, and then versus female candidates, mainly white female candidates. But voters have a tendency to think they're more liberal than they actually are.
Really?
And this was often true of Barack Obama, mm-hmm. that it has mm-hmm. an exaggerated kind of effect, that we have yes. a vision of what a woman would do with power, and we have a vision of what typically a black male would do with power. And so that's why for decades now, at least in my major area of reading, the thinking is that a Republican female will probably be the first female to actually get into office. You know, it's the only Nixon could go to China, you know, because she has to be inoculated by Republican Party, by the Republican Party platform and by sort of this hierarchical orientation of the Republican vision toward the world to make her less threatening, to kind of diminish the woman part, and that would make her more more acceptable. We don't probably still have enough examples of that, and sure. we have lots of counterexamples of that in other states, but nationwide executive leadership, it's just so traditionally masculine and it's so traditionally white mm-hmm. that it's really hard to overcome people's fears, because their fear of change for those new type groups is just so much exaggerated past what those persons' articulated policy platforms and priorities actually are.
And I don't think the vote exists within a vacuum as well. I think the idea is, like Dr. Perry was saying, it's a fear because you have to play to the party itself. So is the goal to push the country forward, or is the goal simply to unite to try to win? Mm-hmm. And back to Barack Obama, you know, he had to dull himself down, right? He had to separate himself from Jeremiah Wright for quoting somebody else who quoted a quote, right? from the U.S. Iraqi ambassador. But the idea is that, you know, this idea of America and the model minority has to be talked about as well, because you have a Mia Love that will bode well inside the Republican Party, her being a black woman, but she's a Republican, or, you know, several different black Republicans that you have right now. But it's the cost of being inside the actual system that you have to take off this identity, that it's not about race or gender or any type of identity politics. It's simply about what it means to be an American. What it means to be American has already been defined as white, Anglo-Saxon, cisgender property owners, right? And so what you have in Donald Trump is the symbol of what America has always wanted it to be. And so the idea of since April 4th, 1968, when Dr. King is assassinated, you had this concerted effort to pull the country back to the right, right, as opposed to the true center that 64 and 65 was working towards. And that's why you have the dismantling of the Civil Rights Act and dismantling of the Voters' Rights Act, and the idea that all these protections are no longer feasible for the federal government to intervene because these groups no longer exist. And to do so is simply special interest. So it's not even really a question of fear. It's a question of what is going to be allowed, you know, even people within your group, you know, let's not make it about race, as opposed to understanding race is not simply about skin color, but it's about experience. And so when you're talking about issues within the black community, you're talking about those that are the most disproportionately affected inside American society. And the question is, are we American? if we are American, then we are citizens. If we are citizens, then we should have rights. And those rights should be inalienable. But when someone else has already defined what the contract is and what rights we are allowed, you can't ask for anything beyond what is already being given to you. And even with Barack Obama, who was literally working within the system, who was a constitutional law professor. And I always like to impose that, I mean, to emphasize that, the idea of him being a constitutional law professor, which means that he was the, tried to be the archetypal president. Mm-hmm. You know, he tried to blend the strengths and weaknesses of all the presidents. But he forgot that all the presidents were all white males, right? And that he didn't have any connection himself personally other than the time he spent in Chicago to really the black experience, to really the poor experience, to really the idea of what it means to be within the marginalized. Yeah, you may have struggled for a couple of years after you got out of Harvard with a bad car. I've read his book. but, I mean, yeah, you can't get a cab, but who can inside New York, right?
Right.
You know what I mean? the idea is that it's not simply just the fear, right? It's the idea that, you know, even if we try, what will happen? You know, we can try. We can do it. We do it. We've been doing it since we got here. We're going to always fight. We're going to always keep fighting. But the question is, what good is going to be using the same strategies? And the question is, are these strategies sustainable? Can we keep employing these same strategies and say, well, you know, better luck next time? Better luck next time got us Donald Trump, right? And it's like, we did everything right, Hillary. Everybody said, okay, we're just going to just hold our nose and we're going to vote. We voted. And she won the popular vote. But it was like he still won, right? And now he has really entrenched himself into a system that even vindicates him even when he's brought up on charges, right? And the question is, what strategy should we use? Should we try to still play by the rules of the game? Or should we kind of get up from the table and say, we got to start a brand new game?
Like Dr. Baptist says, I don't think it's all fear. I don't think it is. Mm-hmm. But directly, based on what I'm seeing locally in my community, there is some of it that's fear. People are scared of change, specifically in areas where, I mean, our city council in Springdale is all white. You know, we do have some women there now, but they're conservative, you know, and they're white. And just that having us disrupting the system does make some people fear. You know, it might not be ultimately their full grasp on what's happening in front of them, that it's scary to them and that they're frightened about it, but it is a factor. And ultimately, when you're a person of color, that you're on the other side, you're trying to make a difference, you're trying to change things, does that affect you to have people in your community that will see you just based on your color and go against you because of what a lot of the folks that have been in the city for many, many years now, like all they know is just conservative values and the way that it's been done for many, many years? Yeah, I mean, it does affect you in some way, but you have to continue pushing and understand that, I mean, it takes hard work and it takes sweat, blood, and tears to make a difference in politics. And going back to the whole racism question, back when I was running in 2016, there was people within my own party that were investigating my criminal record. And I have no criminal record, you know, so they were wanting to make sure that, like, I was a squeaky clean candidate because apparently if I'm a person of color, there must have been something, you know, there must be something that's going on. But no, you know, they even talked to the juvenile judges. They did that. And on election day, which the police have said that this wasn't done purposely, but on election day, two police officers went to vote, but they parked their cars right by the entrance of the voting location.
Mm-hmm.
So there was probably folks that were going to come to vote and that have undocumented family members and might have just turned around and left because there was two police officers, two patrol cars in the front of the entrance at the rodeo, which is the place where the most Latinx people will show up to vote.
Oh, yeah. And that goes back to the idea that all systems seek predictable growth. So when you talk about racism, I think the misperception is that the idea that you look for someone with a Ku Klux Klan robe on and someone using the N-word, right? And I think what Dr. King said, one of our greatest threats is the white moderate that wants to use the idea of diversity and not deal with the fact that we have experiences that are going on, right? So what he's talking about is a specific experience that Latinx and Latinos are experiencing, even within the black community as well. The idea of voter intimidation, the idea of knowing that you knew for the last 40 years that there was going to be an influx in the population and a changing inside the demographic. So this is, like Dr. Perry was saying, this is a long game. And the goal is to not do anything that is race specific, but race neutral. Right. You do things in a way in which does not appear threatening. It seems as though I'm just trying to preserve the order and the law and the status quo. Right. Because that's all the law is, a regulatory and administrative tool to maintain the status quo. You want to simply just say, well, I just want to make sure, even within the party. Right. The idea of holding people accountable and when these type of things occur is how do we deal with these type of issues? Right. Because we only defining racism as this individual thing as opposed to the institutional and systemic thing that manifests itself in various ways and changing who gets the information and changing, you know, if there are police officers out there and changing the polls and doing all types of things that you knew that the system knew that for years, you're going to have an influx of and saw this with the wave, the blue woman wave that came in. Right. That was that caused the fear and threat on the other side, more so this side. But we have to also be aware, like Dr. Carol Anderson argues, of the black of the backlash, or as someone called the blowback. Right. There's always going to be blowback for any type of progress that we make. And I think the idea that we thought that the progress we were making was cemented as opposed to understanding, for example, with Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, that it was only a temporary measure that had to continually be renewed. And it gave the other side time enough to strategize. How do we eventually get this done? How do we remove this? And in turn, allow all these monsters to come back up. And so the idea is, when we talk about racism or white supremacy or whatever that you want to talk about, the idea is that you have to talk about it and not simply in terms of how we traditionally think about white supremacy or patriarchy or sexism or whatever. We have to talk about the idea of words that are used, like the Michelle Vincent cases, words that are used to create hostile environments. You know, use of describing candidates. He won't say anything about his skin color, but you'll say he seems more aggressive. Mm-hmm. He seems more hostile. He doesn't seem well informed or organized enough. His campaign seems to be disjointed, right? And you use these terminologies, and it's real race neutral, but it's race latent. It's a way in which that sends triggers, that sends words. To fight racism is going to take more than understanding that it's not just something that you kill with a silver bullet. That it's a Jabberwocky, you know? You cut one head off, three comes back.
So I began the conversation by asking how you felt about diversity in politics in 2019. So I'm going to bring you to 2020. How are you feeling overall? I know we focused specifically to start with on the presidential election, but in general, as you know, all things are, trends are slow to change. How do you feel overall about where we are and where we're going?
I think presidential election aside, I mean, there is growth. You know, there's growth happening on a national scale. You have Ayanna Pressley, Congressman Ayanna Pressley. You have AOC. You have other folks as well in other parts of the country from Denver's communities that are being part of these leadership positions in Congress and the U.S. Senate. And locally, I mean, there's people taking chances here locally. And I'm seeing it because these are folks that have been organizing in my community and want to take that step, you know, to break those barriers and to create a space for people of color to be in the table and make decisions that affect us on a city level, on a state level. So I'm still very hopeful. I just feel that we all have to continue putting our part to make sure that it continues to move that way, to progress. If we don't, then, I mean, things will remain the same, unfortunately. But luckily, I feel there's a lot of people motivated. There's been a lot of oppression happening, not only from Trump, but from other people around our country. And I think that oppression is causing people to rise and do something about it.
Thank you to today's guests for joining me. Najah K. Baptist is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Arkansas. Irvin Camacho is a community organizer from Springdale and a former Democratic candidate for District 89 state representative. And Janine Perry is a professor of political science at the U of A and director of the Arkansas Poll. Before we end today's show, a few quick reminders about how you can have an impact on what representation looks like in your community right now. First, the deadline to complete the 2020 census is September 30th. The results of this survey, which is conducted once every 10 years, determines the number of seats each state has in the House of Representatives. They're also used to draw congressional and state legislative districts. The results of the census also impact how hundreds of billions of dollars in federal funding are allocated to more than 100 programs, including Medicaid, Head Start, block grants for community mental health services, and SNAP benefits. If you can take 5 minutes to fill out the census at my2020census.gov, you can help shape the future of your community for the next decade. One more deadline, October 5th. That's the last day you can register to vote in Arkansas if you want to vote in the general election November 3rd. Governor Asa Hutchinson has announced the COVID-19 pandemic is a valid excuse for voting absentee. So if you're concerned about voting in person this year, consider requesting an absentee ballot. If you need help registering to vote or requesting an absentee ballot, contact your county clerk's office. I'll share some helpful links about the census, voter registration, and information about ballot issues you'll be able to vote on in the election on our website, argotsoul.com/affirmativeaction. And while you're there, you can also listen to our premiere episode on Black Lives Matter, just in case you missed it last month. If you prefer to listen to us while you're on the go, subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for spending time with us, and be sure to tune in next month for an all-new episode of Affirmative Action. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. We'll see you then.